welcome, listeners, to episode 25 of Hitler's Table Talk on this fine summer evening of August 28, 2014. The reading and commentary of this book is by me, Carolyn Yeager, and soon to join us, Ray Goodwin. Table Talk is the collection of Adolf Hitler's after lunch and dinner conversations or monologues that were recorded in shorthand by trusted aide Heinrich Heine, checked by Martin Bormann, then typed up by Heine. This took place between 1941 and 1944. We are now at February 1942. And as a matter of fact, we're going to begin on February 2nd, 1942 in the evening. And while I'm waiting for Ray to call in, I'll tell you that, and here's his call. There he is.
Hello there.
Hello, Ray.
All right.
Well,
be back.
And so, ladies and gentlemen, this is Ray Goodwin. So I told them that we are going to start with February 2nd, 1942 in the evening. And I thought, you know, Ray, it might be a good idea to kind of give a real brief description of each section. We decided in the beginning not to do that. But it helps people to make some of the changes from one topic to another. And I'll just start this one since I'm already talking by saying that he talks about, actually industrialization and production and unemployment, and compares it with what the Americans do. And he talks about the economy of labor and use of labor and defeating stagnation. And so it's all kind of an economic section here.
Ready to start here.
All
right. Okay. The Fuhrer says, we must achieve higher yields of coal and steel. The rest will follow automatically. Why are some countries industrialized and others not? There are prominent reasons for that. France, for example, has always suffered from lack of coal, and that's why she has never been a great industrial power. The opposite example is that of Great Britain. With us, it's the same. Here, everything is based on coal and iron. Hitherto, we haven't reached our ceiling in any field of industry. It's not until we've solved the problem of the raw materials that we'll be able to have our factories giving 100% production, thanks to ceaselessly alternating shifts. Another factor with which we should reckon is the simplification and improvement of process of manufacture, with the object of economizing on raw material. The mere fact of reducing by two-thirds the wastage in manufacture entails an economy of transport that is far from being negligible. Thus, the improvements made in manufacture help to solve the vital transport problem. The great success of the Americans consists essentially in the fact that they produce quantitatively as much as we do with two-thirds less labor. We've always been hypnotized by the slogan, the craftsmanship of the German worker. We tried to persuade ourselves that we could thus achieve an unsurpassable result. That's merely a bluff of which we ourselves are the victims. A gigantic modern press works with a precision that necessarily outclasses manual labor. American cars, for example, are made with the least possible use of human labor. The first German manufacturer of the sort will be the Volkswagen. In this respect, we are far behind the Americans. Moreover, they build far more lightly than we do. A car of ours that weighs 1,800 kilos would weigh only 1,000 if made by the Americans. It was reading Ford's books that opened my eyes to these matters. In the 20s, the Ford used to cost about $255, whilst the least expensive of our cars, the little Opel, cost 4,600 marks. In America, everything is machine-made so that they can employ the most utter cretins in their factories. Their workers have no need of specialized training and are therefore interchangeable.
He's thinking about the use of Eastern European labor here when he says that you don't have to have a lot of training to do these jobs. And when he means specialized training, I think he means, you know, these really skilled German tool and die workers or something, you know.
Oh, yeah.
These really, you know, good, really skilled workers. But here, he doesn't mean Cretans, actually. He just means, you know, basically people that you just train yourself, train them, and they do this job. It mm-hmm. doesn't take anything real special. Okay.
Right. We must encourage and develop the manufacture of machine tools. The prejudice has for a long time prevailed that such practices would inexorably lead to an increase in unemployment. That's actually true only if the population's standard of living is not raised. Originally, all men were cultivators. Each of them produced everything he needed and nothing else. In the degree to which methods were improved, men were set free from working on the soil and could thereafter devote themselves to other activities. Thus, the artisan class was born. Today, only 27% of the population of Germany is engaged in tilling the soil. In the artisan class, there's been a similar evolution. The improvement in methods of manufacture has made it possible to economize on labor.
Well, you
One
know, Ray, I
looked,
up, I looked up what the percentage of Americans, I didn't go to any other countries, were engaged in agriculture today. And according to the what I saw, it's less than 1% claim farming as an occupation. He's talking about 27% of the population in his time engaged in tilling the soil. We don't have that. And he says about 2% actually live on farms, but they don't actually, they're occupied. Farming is not actually, they live on farms, I guess, but they have other jobs that they actually live off of.
One day an idiot had the idea that men had reached a stage that could not be surpassed, yet progress consists in making life within the limits of the possible more and more agreeable for human beings. It does not consist in stagnation. My idea is that we shall never economize enough on labor. If I found that I needed only half as much labor to build an autobahn, well, I'd build it twice as wide. All this confusion is the work of professors of political economy. The Pontiff of Munich teaches a universal doctrine which is entirely different from the universal doctrine taught by the Pontiff of Leipzig. Only one doctrine, however, can correspond to reality, and that's not necessarily the doctrine taught by either of these pontiffs. It is certainly possible to economize another 30% on our labor. Necessity will make us ingenious. Well, that's paying a lot of attention to his labor force and the workers that are needed and the percentage engaged in agriculture. And like you said, this is an economic thing, Germany is really, really dealing with at this time.
They need this labor so badly.
Yeah.
And when he says, they want to free up the laborers as much as possible by finding, ways to use machinery, and make it easier on the laborers. But after the war, they were accused of war crimes against their laborers. So there you are.
One of the more interesting things in that section for me, Carolyn, was when we, at least from folks from my generation, think about quality of work, we think of handcrafting, craftsmanship what he's describing here as the German worker, and they took such pride in doing so much work by hand, and their parts fit together much better, and the quality of workmanship was so good, and yet he brings out the fact that yes, that's a myth we've been telling ourselves. We do produce a good product, but we may put together one vehicle, and the Americans at the same time are putting together 8 to 12, and that's quality produced too, because they're using these machined parts, machine tools, and things like this. And if we're going to economically progress the way we have to, we're going to have to go to that. We're going to have to go to that mass production stuff ourselves. and you know, and try to keep the loss of any real quality of the German product from happening. But you know, that the time of the artisan or the craftsman there is starting to be eclipsed at that particular time.
Well, you know what I was thinking about too, after, I don't know if some more stuff further along that brought it up, but it fits in right here, is that, you know, in the early days of the National Socialist Movement, they focused on folk crafts and folk arts and everybody, you know, remembering what their grandparents and great-grandparents did and following along the same kind of lifestyle and so on. But now the war, really, the war changed everything. And now they have to compete for so much stuff that has to be manufactured and so on. So that now you could never do things that way, you know,
right,
the old that way, that traditional way and so on. So it's not, you know, a lot of that had to be, I don't think they were focusing on that, emphasizing that later on. That was something they were emphasizing in the beginning to get the German identity back, you know, to get it away
right
from the Jews and the materialism and so on. But then as you're competing in the world on big levels like this, well, you can't really afford to just keep things going that way. So then he went into total progress, you know, and, you know, high level of production and so on. So things did change. You know, we can't just, when we're talking about this period of time and this regime, we can't just go by what was said or done, say, in 1925 and or even in 1932 or 3, and then say that that was would be the same thing as what was being said in 1942.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
Yeah, because the war, as you pointed out, changed everything.
Yeah, it made things necessary.
Sure.
But the German people by that time had already gained all this identity and unity and so on. So they didn't need to do all that anyway, the way they did, and they didn't have Jewish department stores and all that stuff anymore that they were fighting against. So, you know, a lot of that battle had been won anyway.
Right.
By this time.
Right.
And that's why the Germans were able to pull together and stay together so long during this very demanding war and keep up, you know, not give up hope and so on, not give up their patriotism.
Sure.
But anyway, so I've got a timeline for the
right
next part. It's 3rd of November. Not anything more about Japan. The only thing that's going on is with the Japanese. The Japanese air power is thrown against Java, especially the naval base at Surabaya, and then at Port Moresby, New Guinea. The Japanese bombed it, and they're increasing the threat to Australia posed by them. Okay, that's
okay,
all.
Okay, that would be February of 42.
Right.
3rd February, 42, evening. German Freemasonry, Ludendorff's gaffe, a Masonic maneuver, democratic ritual, and Bismarck beaten by a shoemaker. Those kind of outline the topics here. There used to be a large number of Freemasons in Germany who didn't at all know what exactly Freemasonry was. In our lodges, it was above all an occasion for eating, drinking, and amusing oneself. It was a very cleverly adjusted organization. People were kept on the alert. They were entertained with children's rattles, the better to divert their gaze from the essential truth. I knew little towns that were entirely under the dominion of Masonry, much more so than the big towns, for example, Bayreuth and Gotha. Zintz once invited us, Ludendorff, Polner, and myself, to be present at a full-dress gathering of the Lodge of St. John. I refused the invitation, and Zintz reproached me with passing judgment without knowing. I said to him, "Save your saliva. For me, Freemasonry's poison." Ludendorff and Pohner went there, and Ludendorff was even so ill-advised as to put his signature in their register under some stupidly compromising phrase. A few days later, I happened to be visiting Pohner. He was grinning like a monkey. He told me they'd played the same trick on him as on Ludendorff, and that he had written in their book, "Hitherto I believed that Freemasonry was a danger to the state. I now believe, additionally, that it should be forbidden for the offense of major imbecility." Pohner had been dumbfounded by the ridiculousness of these rites, which transformed men who were quite sane and sober in their ordinary lives into informed apes. The Freemasons tried to use Ludendorff's clumsy declaration for publicity purposes, but it goes without saying that with Pohner, they were more discreet. Richard Frank is one of the greatest idealists I've known. Since we needed headquarters, he made efforts to procure the money for us. With this object, he introduced me in Munich to a certain Dr. Kuhlow. On Frank's initiative, this Kuhlow had formed a syndicate to buy the Hotel Eden, situated near the station. It was obviously out of the question to make this purchase with the party's money. This was in 1923, and the sellers demanded payment in Swiss francs. When all was ready, the syndicate met with Kuhlow in the chair. The latter rose to his feet and announced that the hotel would be put at the party's disposal for a modest rental. He suggested in passing that perhaps the party might suppress the article in its program concerning Freemasonry. I got up and said goodbye to these kindly philanthropists. I'd fallen unawares into a nest of Freemasons. How many times subsequently I've heard comments of this sort. Why declaim against the Freemasons? Why not leave the Jews in peace? It's by means of these continual blackmailings that they succeeded in acquiring the subterranean power that acts in all sectors, and each time by appropriate methods. After the prohibition of the lodges, I often heard it said that amongst the former Masons, there were many who felt a sense of relief at the idea that we'd freed them from this chain. Not only has there always been an incompatibility between membership of a lodge and membership of the party, but the fact of having been a Freemason forbids access to the party. Of course, there are men who are so stupid that one knows very well that it was only from stupidity that they became Masons. There are very rare cases in which an exception can be made come exclusively under my authority, and I grant absolution only to men whose entire lives bear witness to their indisputably nationalist feelings. We were obliged to call a general meeting of the party each year to elect the directing committee. The result of the vote, recorded in a minute, had to appear in the Register of Societies. But for this formality, the party would have lost its juridical personality and accompanying rights. This annual meeting had something of a farce about it. I would offer my resignation. Two accountants in the space of 2 hours would succeed in checking a balance for a total movement of funds of $650 million. The president of the assembly, elected ad hoc, would conduct the debates and proceed to the election of the new committee. Voting was by a show of hands. "Who is for? Who is against?" he would ask. His silly questions would arouse storms of mirth. I would then present myself to the registry of the court to have our documents registered. The anti-democratic parties, just like the democratic parties, had to go through these grotesque ceremonies. The other parties had practically no paying members. We, with our 2.5 million members, banked 2.5 million marks every month. Many members paid more than the subscription demanded. At first it was 50 pfennig a month, and then it was raised to a mark. Fräulein Schleifer from the post office used to pay 10 marks a month, for example. Thus, the party disposed of considerable sums. Schwarz was very open-handed when it was a question of large matters, but extremely thrifty in small ones. He was the perfect mixture of parsimony and generosity. It was necessary to have a minimum of 60,000 votes in a district to be entitled to a mandate. Our base was in Bavaria, and here we had 6 mandates to start with, which gave us an equal number of delegates to the Reichstag. There were some extraordinary parties in that republic. The most incredible was Hayhauser's.
Oh.
Yeah. Hauser's.
Now that I see it written, printed, Ray, it's Hauser. Just Hauser's.
Yeah, okay. Just like
what
Hauser.
Mine says is just H-A-U-S-S-E-R.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
I happened to be passing through Stuttgart. This was in 1922 or 23. Frau Waldschmidt suggested that I should go and see this phenomenon without committing myself. I'm fairly sure Hauser was an Alsatian. If my memory is correct, he addressed his audience more or less as follows. You filthy rabble. And it went on in the same tone, consisting solely of insults. In the Munich district, he got a greater number of votes than Stresemann. As for us, we had all the difficulty in the world to have Epp elected. What scatterbrains we sometimes had opposed to us. Let's not complain about it too much. It mustn't be forgotten that one day Bismarck was beaten by a cobbler.
I guess we're supposed to know that about that, which I don't know anything about it, but
yeah.
It's funny.
That's
a funny section. I do want to point out that it didn't pass my attention by that Fraulein Schleifer gave 10 marks a month. See, it was
yes.
The women who were most
yes.
devoted. And maybe Fraulein, that would mean she was a unmarried woman. So if she worked at the post office, she, you know, had enough money and she donated it to the party. Maybe a lot of men had families, they couldn't do that. But there's an example of why he had to like the women.
That's right.
They were such a big help.
Yeah, and I think that's a very important point to bring up, because so many times, I mean, as much as National Socialism is denigrated, you know, a lot of the ignorant say, you know, look how they treated the women. That was a totally masculine thing. It was the macho National Socialist. But the women in Germany supported that party like this lady. Here's a great example, and believed in what it stood for.
Yeah, it was a totally different, you know, I just say that the relationship between German men and women is one that I can't imagine would ever deteriorate,
mm-hmm.
at least not widely so, into any kind of abuse or anything. Just doesn't happen. So women didn't mind having men in charge.
Right.
Women like to have men in charge if they're not, if they behave well. And as that woman who was Stoltz-Klink said one time, that she, you can't imagine what gentlemen they all were, because she was associated with all the top Nazis, because she was the top woman, you know, for the party, I guess, in the women's organizations. I never forget the way she told that to one of these Jews who was interviewing her after the war. You can't imagine what gentlemen they all were.
Mm-hmm. Right. Good point. Well, we'll move to the night of the 3rd and 4th of February, 1942. The topics: memories of Beirut, the automobile craze, leaving Landsberg, the reconstitution of the party, and the world will recapture its sense of joy. I've been lucky that I never had an accident while traveling. You know the story of the Hound of the Baskervilles. On a sinister, stormy night, I was going to Beirut through the Fish de Gaberica. I'd just been saying to Maurice, "Look out on the bend." I'd scarcely spoken when a huge black dog hurled itself on our car. The collision knocked it into the distance. For a long time, we could hear it howling in the night.
That's sad.
That made me so sad. Yeah,
I figured
dog
was hurt, and it was off there, you know,
yes.
crying.
And you know it had to have gotten to him, being the
animal
lover.
Yeah, that's what I thought of. That's why he's remembered it, and he's mentioning it here. It must have hurt him a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you can't do anything about it. It's like when you run into a deer here. You know, they just run in front of you. You can't avoid them at all.
Right.
And this was at night in a storm. Wow, that is a kind of a...
A sad note.
Sad story, yeah.
I'd settle down with the Becksteins within a few yards of Wanfried. On the morning of my arrival, Cosima Wagner gave me a visit, which I returned in the course of the day. Siegfried was there. Bayreuth exerted its full charm upon me. I was 36 years old, and life was delightful. I had all the pleasures of popularity without any of the inconveniences. Everybody put himself out to be nice to me, and nobody asked anything of me. By day, I'd go for a walk in leather shorts. In the evening, I'd go to the theater in a dinner jacket or tails. Afterwards, we would prolong the evening in the company of actors, either at the theater restaurant or on a visit to Berneck. My supercharged Mercedes was a joy to all. We made many excursions, going once to Luxembourg, another time to Bamberg, and very often to the Hermitage. There are a lot of photos of me taken at this time, which Frau Beckstein has. She used often to say to me, "You deserve to have the finest motor car in the world. I wish you had a Maybach." The first thing I did on leaving the prison at Landsberg on the 20th of December 1924 was to buy my supercharged Mercedes. Although I've never driven myself, I've always been passionately keen on cars. I liked this Mercedes particularly. At the window of my cell in the fortress, I used to follow with my eyes the cars going by on the road to Kaufbrunnen and wonder whether the time would return when I would ride in a car again. I discovered mine by reading a prospectus. At once, I realized that it would have to be this or none. 26,000 marks. It was a lot of money. I can say that as to what gives the Mercedes-Benz its beauty nowadays, I can claim the fatherhood. During all these years, I've made innumerable sketches with a view to improving the line. Adolf Muller had taught me to drive all right, but I knew that at the slightest accident, my conditional liberty would be withdrawn, and I also knew that nothing would have been more agreeable to the government. In November of 1923, I was already owner of a marvelous Benz. On the 9th, it was in Mueller's garage under lock and key. When the police came to seize it, they must have filed through the chain, but they dared not use it in Munich because the whole population would have risen in revolt, shouting, "Car thieves!" So they sent it to Nuremberg, where it immediately had an accident. I've bought it back since, and it can be seen among our relics. It was a queer experience when the mufti of the prison came to me with all sorts of circumlocution and panting with emotion. "You're free!" I couldn't believe it was true. I'd been sentenced to 6 years. I owe my liberation to the juryman Hermann, a scowling, supercilious man who, throughout the trial, had looked at me with a grim expression. I supposed him to be a member of the Bavarian People's Party, reflecting that the government had doubtless appointed jurymen to suit it. Through Hermann, I learnt the details of my trial. The jury wanted to acquit me. On the evidence of my defense, they were convinced that Carr, Lassau, and Sasser must have been equally guilty. They were informed of the objection that an acquittal might entail the risk of having the affair referred to the court at Leipzig. This made the jury reflect. They decided it was prudent to have me found guilty, the more so as they had been promised a remission of the sentence after 6 months. This had been a little piece of knavery on the court's part, for they had no reason to suppose that an appeal by the public prosecutor could have resulted in the case being referred to the Supreme Court. In fact, it's certain that Carr, Lassau, and Sasser would not have appeared at Leipzig. Since the promise of conditional liberation was not kept, Hermann wrote to the government informing it that the three jurymen would appeal to public opinion if I were not set free immediately. When I left Landsberg, everybody wept, the mufti and the other members of the prison staff, but not I. We'd won them all to our cause. The Mufti came to tell me that Ludendorff, on the one hand, and the popular bloc, on the other, wanted to send a car for me. Since he was afraid of demonstrations, I reassured him by saying, I'm not keen on demonstrations. I'm keen only on my freedom. I added that I would make no use of the offers of transport, but it would be agreeable to me if my printer, Adolf Mueller, might come and fetch me. Do you permit me, he asked, to inform the government to that effect? These gentlemen would be much reassured. Mueller accordingly arrived, accompanied by Hoffman. What a joy it was for me to be in a car again. I asked Mueller whether he couldn't accelerate. No, he replied. It's my firm intention to go on living for another 25 years. At Pasing, we met the first messengers on motorcycles. I found them gathered at my door in the Tierstrasse in Munich, men like Fuss, Gar, and the other old faithfuls. My apartment was decorated with flowers and laurel wreaths. I've kept one of them. In his exuberant joy, my dog almost knocked me down the stairs. The first visit I paid was to Poner. He could almost have kissed me, he who had in front of him what I had behind me. He had a conversation with Kramer Kleitel, asking him to inform Held that I maintained my demand that all my men should also be set at liberty. Held granted me an appointment, and I must acknowledge that his attitude was entirely correct. Thus, later on, I refrained from making any trouble for him, unlike what I did for Schweier. Held asked me whether, if I started the party up again, I contemplated associating myself with Ludendorff. I told him that such was not my intention. Held then told me that because of the attitude taken up by Ludendorff toward the church, he found himself obliged to oppose him. I assured him that the party program did not entail a struggle with the church, and that Ludendorff's affairs were no concern of mine. Held undertook to get in touch with the Minister of Justice and to inform me of the decisions that would be taken concerning my men. The news reached Poner that Gertner, the Minister of Justice, refused to be persuaded that my demand was justified. I again visited Held, who advised me to go and see Gertner. There I fell in with a lawyer. He opposed me with the lawyer's arguments. My men, he claimed, had not been imprisoned as long as I had. In any case, he couldn't set them free before the vacation. Besides, he hadn't the files. I had no difficulty in replying to him that the files were not necessary, that I knew all the names. During my enumeration, he reacted violently at the name of Hess. Not him, in any case. He exposed ministers to the risk of being stoned by the crowd. What can we do about that? Is it our fault that you are so unpopular? Besides, nothing happened to you. My point of view was as follows. It was not possible for my men to remain in prison whilst I, who was responsible for everything, was at liberty. Held confessed to me that he did not understand Gertner's attitude. The latter, by reason of his belonging to the National German Party, should have felt closer to me than Held himself. It was finally Poner who, with extreme brutality, informed Gertner of his views. On returning home one evening, I found a message signed by my 13 companions. They had just been set free. The next morning, Schaub came to fetch my mail. He had lost his job. He has never left me since that moment. I had already borrowed 300 marks to pay for the taxis that the newly liberated men had to take when they left Landsberg, but they were already in Munich when I learnt of their liberation. I didn't know what to do with my first evening of freedom. I had the impression that at any moment a hand would be laid on my shoulder, and I remained obsessed by the idea that I'd have to ask leave for anything I wanted to do. During the first weeks, I remained quiet, but time seemed to me to drag. I regained contact with reality and began by reconciling the enemy brothers. On the 27th, January 1925, I again founded the party. My 13 months of imprisonment had seemed a long time, the more so because I thought I'd be there for 6 years. I was possessed by a frenzy of liberty. But without my imprisonment, Mein Kampf would not have been written. That period gave me the chance of deepening various notions for which I then had only an instinctive feeling. It was during this incarceration, too, that I acquired that fearless faith, that optimism, that confidence in our destiny, which nothing could shake thereafter. It's from this time, too, that my conviction dates, a thing that many of my supporters never understood, that we could no longer win power by force. The state had had time to consolidate itself, and it had the weapons. My weakness in 1923 was to depend on too many people who were not ours. I'd warned Hess that it would take us 2 years to give the party a solid foundation, and after that, the seizure of power could only be a matter of 5 to 10 years. It was in accordance with these predictions that I organized my work. There are towns
okay,
in Germany.
Okay, now he's going to go off into this other topic here, kind of.
Yeah,
so maybe
right.
We could do any commenting that we want to do about
okay.
this while it's fresh in the minds of the listeners. Well, I have to go back so far. There was one thing. Was there anything you wanted to comment on here, Ray?
Well, yeah, I mean, him pointing out that an interesting thing was he, in January 27th, 1925, I again founded the party. Most people think that the National Socialist Organization, the party went right on when he was thrown in prison. But their job was, you know, the intent of the government was to demolish that party and totally put it out of business. And sure enough, I mean, they disrupted it and practically, tore it up, really. And so when Hitler got out of Landsberg, then he had to start organizing things again, get his veterans back with him, his the brains of the outfit, if you will, the thinkers, and get his party founded again to get it back in business, because essentially it had been shut down with him in prison. And
right.
so, that's why he goes back to me and reminds everybody what a struggle it was, and it wasn't just the initial founding of the party. It had to be done a second time.
Yeah, and then you know this part here about this man, Hermann, and how he is telling that the jury wanted to acquit him, but there
mm-hmm.
was some kind of, you know, legal shenanigans going on, and they talked him out of it. And then they promised that they would release him in 6 months, and then they didn't. And so this Hermann, he said, wrote and threatened to tell this to the public
right.
if they didn't set him free. Well, I've never read any of this before. Now, that doesn't mean
right.
it's not somewhere, but have you ever seen that before?
No.
No.
That was
interesting
something.
Story, yeah. Mm-hmm. And... then otherwise, just he's trying to let us know that he was he never deserted anybody, and I'm sure that's true. You know, he insisted that his companions who were in prison there with him be released also. And you know, the fact is that at that time, the way you could talk to these bureaucrats and so on, and functionaries and in a real way, and get people to do things. And of course, this was in Bavaria, and it was, you know, a separate state and had its own rules, and people did things the way they did things there. And he had been there for a long time. He knew a lot of people, and a lot of people were not they were bureaucratic, but they listened. You know, they were reasonable. And they did things. He got a lot of things done just by trying to convince people to do them. And they thought, well, I guess, you know, there's no reason not to or whatever. But or maybe he had the law on his side. But it's pretty interesting that there was more of a German friendliness, I mean, you know, than there
yes.
is now. You know, I mean, people weren't at each other's throats. In the way that now with this world, with the U.S. in charge of everything in Germany.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it was... Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that this section also demonstrates his popularity with, for lack of a better expression, the little guys. That, you know, the cops, I call them, the police took his car, you know, but like he said, they knew better than to try to use it or whatever, because of the populace would holler car thieves at them and everything like this. And that shows the ground based support that the man had, which grew, of course, over in the next few years until, you know, 98% of the vote came his way. But it was people were attracted and drawn to him.
It was a more personal community, not so impersonal. Not as impersonal as what we have now.
That's a good point,
and interesting. Okay, well, now this next part is pretty darn interesting, too.
Oh, yeah, okay. There are towns in Germany from which all joy is lacking. I'm told that it's the same thing in certain Calvinistic regions of Switzerland. In Trier and Freiburg, women have addressed me in so ignoble a fashion that I cannot make up my mind to repeat their words. It's on such occasions that I become aware of the depth of human baseness. Clearly, one must not forget that these areas are still feeling the weight of several centuries of religious oppression. Near Würzburg, there are villages where literally all the women were burned. We know of judges of the Court of the Inquisition who gloried in having had 20,000 to 30,000 witches burned. Long experience of such horrors cannot but leave indelible traces upon a population. In Madrid, the sickening odor of the heretic's pyre remained for more than two centuries, mingled with the air one breathed. If a revolution breaks out again in Spain, one must see in it the natural reaction to an interminable series of atrocities. One cannot succeed in conceiving how much cruelty, ignominy, and falsehood the intrusion of Christianity has spelt for this world of ours. If the misdeeds of Christianity were less serious in Italy, that's because the people of Rome, having seen them at work, always knew exactly the worth of the popes before whom Christendom prostrated itself. For centuries, no pope died except by the dagger, poison, or the pox. I can very well imagine how this collective madness came to birth. A Jew was discovered to whom it occurred that if one presented abstruse ideas to non-Jews, the more abstruse these ideas were, the more the non-Jews would rack their brains trying to understand them. The fact of having their attention fixed on what does not exist must make them blind to what exists. An excellent calculation of the Jew's part. So the Jew smacks his thighs to see how his diabolic stratagem has succeeded. He bears in mind that if his victims suddenly became aware of these things, all Jews would be exterminated. But this time, the Jews will disappear from Europe. The world will breathe freely and recover its sense of joy when this weight is no longer crushing its shoulders. So.
Well, that's fantastic.
Oh, I'll tell you. You know, and I personally, I appreciate that he will... He often brings this up. I mean, it's kind of in the forefront of his thinking, and I appreciate it.
Yes, and, you know, there's two things here. When he talks about the atrocities of the church, he's talking in a way not as a man who would commit atrocities himself on anybody, you know, even on Jews. I mean, you know, he doesn't like atrocities. And then also, he says down here towards the end, he says that the Jews would have been exterminated in the past, but this time they're going to disappear from Europe. Let's see, how does he put this?
Says, yeah, that's the way he said it, yeah.
Yeah, he said because of what the Jews were doing back then.
Yeah, if people woke up to that, then
Jews
would be exterminated.
Yeah, people realize what they had done all these years and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But he says, but this time the Jews will disappear from Europe. And, you know, he means, that's his beautiful vision, that they would go somewhere else.
Right.
So these kind of things that he's saying, and this is 1942, and I don't think he's using code language or he's saying this on purpose to try to lead people astray or future historians or anything like that. You
oh,
know?
Yeah.
He didn't think that he wasn't doing anything like that, so it has to be the way he thought and saw things. And then he talks about how the world will breathe freely and recover its sense of joy. That's great. And that's why he liked sunny climates, and he liked the South, too. He appreciated the South because he thought there was a sense of joy there, even in spite of the fact that Italy had the church all those years. It hadn't taken that away from it. And he didn't appreciate so much the dourness of the cold and rainy north, you know.
Oh, yeah. Hey, you brought up something important to me there, Carolyn, when you talked about, Hitler was not speaking in some kind of code here when he says the Jews would be exterminated. And when I was going through the college and all assigned readings by our professor, one of them was by this Lucy Davidovits, and of course it was just Jewish trash was all it was. And in that book,
yeah, for the listeners, she's a well-known Holocaust historian.
Oh,
she,
yeah,
she writes, you know, all pro-Holocaust books.
Right, and her book was required reading in that class, and it didn't take me just a few pages. I thought, this is not worthy of a history class, because she would throw quotes up there, and she would say, when he said this, he probably meant this, you know, offering nothing, no substantiation, not anything. And this is supposed to be something we're supposed to use our valuable time on. This woman saying that when he says this, he probably meant this, or in code, he was actually saying this. And just all it was strictly opinion and a rant from this Jewess, and it wasn't worth one iota of a minute of historical study or time.
Yeah.
And, you know, but that's just something you deal with this subject.
Yeah, that's right. The way they bring that stuff into history is terrible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Nothing to it. Okay, we'll move on to 4th of February, 1942, evening, and special guest, Himmler. Headings of this section, Charlemagne, the call of the South, struggling through the mud, Henry the Lion, the sweetness of life, improving living conditions, and for the Reich, no sacrifice is too great. The fact that Charlemagne was able to federate the quarrelsome and bellicose Germans shows that he was one of the greatest men in world history. We know today why our ancestors were not attracted to the east, but rather to the south, because all the regions lying east of the Elbe were like what Russia is for us today. The Romans detested crossing the Alps. The Germanic peoples, on the other hand, were very fond of crossing them, but in the opposite direction. One must bear in mind that at this period, Greece was a marvelous garden in which oak forest alternated with orchards. It was only later that olive growing was introduced into Greece. The reason why the climate has become temperate in Upper Bavaria is that Italy was deforested. The warm winds of the south, which are no longer held in check by the vegetation, pass over the Alps and make their way northwards. The Germanic needed a sunny climate to enable his qualities to develop. It was in Greece and Italy that the Germanic spirit found the first terrain favorable to its blossoming. It took several centuries to create, in the Nordic climate, the conditions of life necessary for civilized man. Science helped there. For any Roman, the fact of being sent to Germania was regarded as a punishment, rather like what it used to mean to us to be sent to Posen. You can imagine those rainy, gray regions transformed into quagmires as far as the eye could see. The megalithic monuments were certainly not places of worship, but rather places of refuge for people fleeing from the advance of the mud. The countryside was cold, damp, dreary. At a time when other people already had paved roads, we hadn't the slightest evidence of civilization to show. Only the Germanics on the shores of the rivers and the seacoast were, in a feeble way, an exception to this rule. Those who had remained in Holstein have not changed in 2,000 years, whilst those who have immigrated to Greece raised themselves to the level of civilization. What persists through the centuries in a people's customs is what relates to their habits of eating. I am convinced that the soup of Holstein is the origin of the Spartan gruel. As regards the archaeological discoveries made in our part of the world, I'm skeptical. The objects in question were doubtless made in entirely different regions. Their presence would indicate that they were articles of exchange, which the Germanics of the coast obtained for their amber. In the whole of northern Europe, the level of civilization cannot much have surpassed that of the Maoris, and that's M-A-O-R-I-S, and those were New Zealand Aborigine people. Nevertheless, the Greek profile and that of the Caesars is that of the men of this north of ours, and I'd wager that I could find amongst our peasants 2,000 heads of that type. If Henry the Lion had not rebelled against the imperial power, certainly nobody would ever have had the notion of expanding to the east. Supposing he'd succeeded, the Slav world would have been given a Germanic ruling class, but it wouldn't have gone further than that. All these strivings toward the east were translated into a loss of Germanic blood to the profit of the Slavs. I prefer to go to Flanders on foot rather than eastwards in a sleeping car. It has always been my delight toward March to leave Munich and go to meet the spring in the Rhineland. On the way back, one leaves the sweetness of living behind as one passes the mountains of Swabia. There is still a smiling valley near Ulm, and then one is definitely caught once more by the rude climate of the high Bavarian plain. I'm sorry for those who have to suffer this hardening process permanently. Yet we've made those inclement regions habitable. In the same way, we'll transform the spaces of the East into a country in which human beings will be able to live. We must not forget that over there are found iron, coal, grain, and timber. We'll build their welcoming farms, handsome roads, and those of our people who thrust as far as that will end by loving their country and loving its landscapes, as the Germans on the Volga used to do. You'll understand, Himmler, that if I want to establish a genuine civilization to the north and east, I'll have to make use of men from the south. If I were to take official architects of the Prussian government to beautify Berlin, for example, I'd do better to abandon the project. In our ambition to play a role on the world level, we must constantly consult imperial history. All the rest is so new, so uncertain, so imperfect. But imperial history is the greatest epic that's been known since the Roman Empire. What boldness, what grandeur. These giants thought no more of crossing the Alps than crossing a street. The misfortune is that none of our great writers took his subjects from German imperial history. Our Schiller found nothing better to do than to glorify a Swiss crossbowman. The English, for their part, had a Shakespeare. But the history of his country has supplied Shakespeare, as far as heroes are concerned, only with imbeciles and madmen. Immense vistas open up to the German cinema. It will find in the history of the empire 5 centuries of world domination, themes big enough for it. When I meet the heads of other Germanic peoples, I'm particularly well placed, by reason of my origin, to discuss with them. I can remind them, in fact, that my country was for 5 centuries a mighty empire with a capital like Vienna, and that nevertheless I did not hesitate to sacrifice my country to the idea of the Reich. I've always been convinced of the necessity of welcoming into the party only truly sturdy fellows, without taking heed of numbers and excluding the lukewarm. In the same way, as regards the new Reich, wherever there are wholesome Germanic elements in the world, we shall try to recover them. And this Reich will be so sturdy that nobody will ever be able to attempt anything against it. There's that optimistic mood, you know, on display, and a certainty that what the party and he set out to do was the right, was exactly what needed to be done.
Yeah, and that his faith that amongst the German people, there were the kind of people that it took and the kind of people that could accomplish it and keep it going. Of course, he had to believe that because if all that he had devoted his life to, would, when he passed away, would disappear, you know. You'd have to have people to carry on. And
sure.
And so that's why he knew that his system, the meritorious system, and he says, seeking Germanic elements wherever they are to recover the best, you know, the best that's there, and put it to work for the entire Reich. He's always talking about the Reich. He's never talking really about the world or all Europeans,
right,
or something,
right,
like that. He's always talking about the Reich. And then a strong Reich will assure a good life for all the rest of these people. Really, I do believe that's his belief.
Well,
and his
yeah, and he states those very, very lofty goals and ambitions for his nation, and it's beautiful. And it just pains one to realize that war thrust upon Germany by, I call them the enemies of mankind, robbed us of the dream to come true, you know, and to come to fruition, which would have been for the good of all. And it's sad, you know, when you read his words about that and what he has a vision for the future, and we're going to do this, we're going to accomplish that, and you just wish, Lord, why didn't
and
that
it, yeah, and it wasn't just
true.
A pipe dream, because they were doing it. I mean, he's gotten so far with it, you know. And now speaking, that brings me to the architects, because unfortunately, so much that was designed was never built. As he's saying here, that he needs to get his architects from the south to build up the north, because they were better. You know, they had a better sense of what was beautiful. And I'm sure he was thinking of his two mate. Well, he had there were a number of good architects, but Speer and Giesler were the ones that worked most closely with him. And they were both from the south. Speer was from the Rhineland, and Giesler from Munich. And there was another one, Fick, I think, and he was from down there, too. So sometimes, you know, he acts like he's partial to Berlin and the north part of Germany, and other times, and he makes fun of Munich or the southern Germans and the Austrians, and other times he acts like sees all the strength and talents in them, and he acts like he prefers that. But I don't think he had any actual preference.
Just
depends on what he's talking about.
Just so meritocracy prevailed and the right people for the right job.
Yeah. But I thought that was a great part. Like, he'll even say that Schiller, he's disappointed that Schiller glorified a Swiss crossbowman instead of writing about the great imperial history. Because Schiller was probably the greatest German poet. Of course, he was a playwright, dramatist. And, you know, he's talking about William Tell there.
Yes.
The story of Wilhelm Tell.
Yes.
Yeah, well, that is a great work by Schiller. It makes it extremely inspirational. But Hitler's right. It's just about a Swiss crossbowman. It's not about one of the great military heroes or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Well, you just find all kinds of stuff in here, you know.
Oh, my goodness.
Somebody
That's
commented
true.
On that just the other day. Wrote a comment about it, or an email to me, I don't know which, but that that there's no end of little insights and so on in this book, that he's really enjoying it. So listening in, he's really enjoying the way we're doing it, he said. That was nice of him.
Well, that's much appreciated, and I feel exactly
we do our best,
does,
don't we? Yeah.
You bet.
Anyway, okay, we may not be the best, but we're doing our best, so.
And we give it our best shot, don't we?
Yeah, right.
Okay, moving on to February 5th, 1942, midday. A raid on the Brown House, the Munich Putsch, imprisoned ministers. One day the police made a raid on the Brown House. I had in my strongbox some documents of the highest importance. One of the keys I had on me, and I happened to be in Berlin. The other was in Hess's possession. The police demanded that he should open the strongbox. He excused himself for not being able to do so, pleading that I was absent and it was I who had the key. The police, therefore, had to content themselves with putting seals on the box and waiting for my return. Hess had informed me by telephone of this search. 2 days later, he told me I could return. The fact was, he had noticed that it was possible to unscrew the handles on which the seals had been placed. Very cleverly, Hess had himself performed this operation, had opened the box with his own key, and had shut it again, replacing the seals, after having emptied it of compromising documents. On
good
my
for
return,
him.
The police. Yeah.
Yeah. But, clever.
Anyway,
of
on my return, the police presented themselves for the opening of the strongbox. I protested very energetically in order to induce them to threaten me that they'd resort to force. I then decided to unlock the box. The lid was open. The box contained nothing. Their discomfited expressions were a pleasure to behold. On another occasion, I was present when the police took the Brown House by storm. The crowd in the street hurled insults at the policemen who were straddling over the railings. At the windows of the Nuncio's palace on the other side of the street, where one never saw anyone, there were gloating faces of fat ecclesiastics. The search, which was unfruitful, went on until the middle of the night. What a struggle there was before we could obtain the right to hoist our flag over the Brown House. The police were against it, but they were not themselves in agreement on the subject, and they even brought us in to be present at their disputes. For once, our luck lay in the immeasurable stupidity of the lawyers. Our skill triumphed over their arguments. This detail shows that one should in no circumstances put one's trust in lawyers. They certainly won't defend our regime any better than they defended its predecessor. Little by little, there was a revulsion in our favor. Now and then, a policeman would come and whisper into our ears that he was at heart on our side. More and more, we could count on genuine supporters amongst them who did not hesitate to compromise themselves for the party and through whom we learnt whatever was afoot. A particularly repulsive individual was Hermann in 1923. He was one of the chiefs of the criminal police. Believing in our success, he put himself at our disposal as soon as we'd proceeded to the arrest of members of the government, offering us his help in laying our hands on those who had escaped our net. When the affair had turned out badly, we knew that he'd be one of the chief witnesses for the prosecution, and we were very curious to see how he'd behave. We were ready, according to what he said, to shut his mouth by saying to him, "Wasn't it you, Hermann, who handed Wutzelhofer over to us?" But he was as dumb as a carp. It was Weber who opened up for us, unknown to the proprietor, the Villa Lehmann, in which we locked up the members of the government. We threatened them that if a single one of them attempted to flee, we'd shoot them all. Their panic was so great that they remained shut up for 2 days, though the revolution had come to an end long before. When Lehmann returned to his house, he was quite surprised to discover this brilliant assemblage. A few days later, Lehmann even had the surprise of receiving a visit from a daughter of one of the ministers. She'd come to fetch a signet ring that her father claimed to have forgotten between the pages of a book he had taken from the library. Instead of a signet ring, what she was looking for was a pile of foreign banknotes that the father had slipped into a book by the poet Storm. Anyway,
that ends kind of abruptly there.
Yes, it did. Yeah. anyway, February 5th.
Well,
go ahead.
Let me see here. There was, I thought there was something. But these are like little anecdotes he's telling. And it's about their relations basically with the police, right? And the relations, they had difficulties with the police, but they also had friends among the police.
That's right.
And I don't think this Herman is the same Herman that was mentioned above.
Mm-hmm.
That's a pretty common name. Wasn't that Herman, too, that was mentioned above as the
on
the jury? Now, this is a policeman named Herman. Okay.
Yeah, but, you know, that I thought that was good, too, where, you know, he said not only, sure, the police harassed him and gave him a rough time, but not only did some of them come and say, look, you know, I'm in sympathy with what you're trying to do here, but they provided valuable information to Hitler and his party about the moves being planned and plotted against him. And, you know, that's why I say his people, his party, its goals had followers that believed in it. And even though they may have been part of the what we would call the establishment, they in their hearts, they were hoping for the best for him and his people. And so, you know, once again, that tells me that just was the origins of the groundswell that eventually got the National Socialist Party as the leaders of Germany. And
it had to have been a lot of fun, too, although stressful, but fun in a way, because you had to have your wits about you all the time. I think Hitler liked that, because he liked the matching wits, and he liked winning in these little ways and so on. And so it was stimulating. Very stimulating. You have to be young enough for it, but it's good he's telling all these stories.
Yes.
All right, so that's all I wanted to say.
Okay, so we'll go to this section here. The 5th of February, 1942, evening. Excursions with Baroness Abegg, the fake Donatello, a dubious Murillo. I would find no pleasure in living all the time on the banks of the Koenigsee. It's too depressing. None of our lakes is so reminiscent of the Norwegian forts. By contrast, it gives one an impression of a fairyland to arrive there after having come along the Kiemsee, whose blurred tints are so restful to the eye. I've made innumerable excursions on the mountain led by the Baroness Abegg. Without her, I'd probably never have been on the summit of the Chinner. She was indefatigable and could climb like a goat. All that was arranged by Eckhart, who didn't care for walking and could thus remain in peace at the boarding house. Dietrich Eckhart used to say that she was the most intelligent woman he'd ever known. I'd have been willing to accept the intelligence if it hadn't been accompanied by the most spiteful tongue imaginable. The woman was a real scorpion. She was as blonde as flax, with blue eyes and excessively long canine teeth like an English woman. I admit she was remarkably intelligent, a woman in the class of Frau Bruckmann. She had traveled a lot all over the world. She was always in one or other of two extreme states. The first kept her at home in a state of almost complete collapse. She would sprawl on her veranda like a run-down battery while everybody around her was kept busy attending to her. The second state was one of incredible petulance. She'd fly into a rage, sweep out like a whirlwind, climb up somewhere, and come rushing torrentially down again. In my opinion, the most attractive thing about her was the famous bust by Donatello. She valued it at 150,000 marks in gold. In the event of a sale, half the money was to go to the party funds, which could have enabled us to solve all the difficulties caused by the inflation. Unfortunately, nobody believed in the authenticity of this Donatello. When I saw her for the first time, my instinct immediately told me it was a fake. She claimed that the stucco worker in whose home she'd bought it had no knowledge of its value. At the best, it could only be a bad copy. The Baroness's husband had thrown himself into the Koenigsee as can well be understood. At his place, I'd have done the same. Of the two faithful admirers whom she was known to have, one died and the other went mad. That story reminds me of the story of Simon Eckert's Murillo. The picture contained a fault in design that could not have escaped Murillo's attention. If it had done so, there were people in his entourage who would have called it to his attention. These great painters used often to work in collaboration. One of them would paint the Madonna, another the flowers, etc. I intended to write a play on the subject of this Murillo. A man who was furious was the banker Simon Eckert. What a difference between the two Eckerts. A whole world separated them. Dietrich was the writer, full of idealism. Simon was a man deeply immersed in the realities of nature.
Well, there's another kind of sudden ending. This brings us to part three.
Right.
And so let's talk about this a little bit, and I don't think we'll go any further tonight.
Fine.
This is 6th February, and what is... I'm looking at part three. This little section is about art, and for those who might not know, Donatello is a very highly thought of sculptor from, what, the Renaissance period, or maybe a little pre-Renaissance, and it must be, I'm forgetting my art history here, in Italy, and has a lot of sculptures, but supposedly this woman thought this bust, you know, these are the forgeries, thought was trying to pass it off as real, but nobody thought it was. And then the Murillo, too, a famous Spanish painter, that obviously there was a painting, and there were some problems with it, and this Simon Eckert wanted to believe that it was a genuine Murillo. Now, what I didn't even get this far, so I didn't look up anything about Simon Eckert. Do you know anything about him, Ray?
No, I don't either. I didn't get to look that up. You know, he calls him the man who was furious was the banker, Simon Eckert.
I wonder if he's supposed to be related to Dietrich Eckert, or if he's just, gee whiz.
With the same last name, or they kin, but, and, you know, he refers to him as the two Eckerts, and the whole world separated them.
Well, he's not famous, so... he's not on Wikipedia, or I can't Google him and find anybody. So he was just a banker that they knew.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, anything more you want to comment on here?
Well, no, I think, you know, that was just another bunch of little tidbits that are fascinating, and his discussion of that gal there about, she was probably the, like Dietrich Eckert called her, the most intelligent woman he ever knew. And Hitler said, I would agree with intelligence, but boy, the Spitfire side of her came through all the time, and she was a real alien. But that's some interesting stuff, you know. And it's just one of the human things that he brings up every once in a while. It just brings everything, keeps everything grounded, brings it back to earth. So it was an enjoyable little section. And as you've said, we've reached part three in this book, and it says 1942, the 6th of February to the 7th of September, and so that's what section three will take us to, and we'll start that in the next show.
Yeah, because I think we've covered quite a bit. So, we're coming up to the Labor Day weekend, so we have a few minutes here. I'll just ask you, what are you going to do for Labor Day weekend?
Well, I'm going to take a trip to Waco, Texas, and I'm going to take in that brand new football stadium there and see Baylor and SMU play a little football on Sunday evening, and I actually start my football announcing here this Friday night. The season gets underway for that, and
Well, that's right. And we could cover that a little bit, because I was going to ask you separately, because you have, that's nice that you're going to the ball game. You'll enjoy that. And I guess it'll be special because it's a kind of a holiday thing. But
right.
you do this ball game announcing this time of
yes.
year. And you've got one coming up on a Thursday, and we're going to move the day of the Hitler's Table Talk on that Thursday, maybe to Wednesday, either to Wednesday or Friday, probably to Wednesday. So when is that?
Well, let's see. Today is Thursday. That's next Thursday, Carolyn. I have a Friday night ball game tomorrow night, which starts that high school season. And then, ironically, next week is the only week in the entire season that I have a Thursday night ball game as well as a Friday night one. So, if we move it,
what am I talking about? August? What did I say? I'm writing down February here for some reason.
Yeah, it's September.
September 4th.
Yes, and 5th. I have ball games on those nights, and... you know, it's a hobby, but it's a little bit of a job. I've obligated myself to it, and this is my 25th year up in that booth, and I enjoy the sidetrack that it gives me just to take in some high school football and see a lot of teams that come through our city and all, and it's a little spending money. Doesn't pay a great deal, but it's a little spending money, and it's an enjoyable hobby. And so, yeah, it's Friday nights, naturally, but this is one time where I've got a Thursday game, and they schedule one for us next week. And so it's that day, Carolyn. It's a week from today that I will be at the stadium. I'll be obligated to do that.
Good thing. So I can right now announce to our listeners, and I will, of course, make more of an announcement, post it, but we'll be scheduling this Hitler's Table Talk program next week for September 3rd on a Wednesday.
Right.
Wednesday, September 3rd, so that you'll be here. And I think that's really neat that you do that announcing. Well, see, with Blog Talk, we can do that without any problem. So there are some good things about Blog Talk. I don't have anything else on that schedule for that day, for Wednesday.
Yeah.
So, but that's really nice that you do that announcing. I bet you do it really well, too. I'd like to hear it sometime.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I do have fun with it, and I guess with a track record of this being my 25th year, the independent school district here probably would not ask me back unless I was doing a credible job. So it feels good.
25 years. Know. Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
That's really a long time. And do you have a partner up there? Is there two of you, or do you just do it by yourself?
We have a five-person crew, Carolyn, and two of them run the scoreboard and the game clock, and the main fellow that works with me is my spotter, and he has a pair of binoculars on, and he follows the defense, and I tell him, hey, I'll stick with the ball carrier and the offense, and you watch the defense, and you tell me who makes the tackles, who covers the fumble, things like this. And I watch that side of the ball. He watches the other. And it really makes for an efficient job of announcing. I had to do it for a number of years without any help, without a spotter, and I was just unable to give the kids the credit they deserved, and because it was too much to follow, and the people in charge didn't want to spend a little bit of money of having another person in the booth until finally we got an athletic director that realized, hey, you know, we need what the more efficient schools have, and they decided to hire a spotter for me, and he and I have been best buddies since junior high school, and I was real glad to get him up in the booth with me. So he contributes a great deal to my success up in the booth, and so we work as a crew, and we're a good team.
Well, that's terrific. You're a real hero, Ray. You know what I did? I just lost my Blog Talk. I have to get it back here. Hold on. Well, all right, then. It looks like we're going to end this program just a little bit earlier than we usually do, but So this, ladies and gentlemen, this has been Hitler's Table Talk, episode 25, and I am Carolyn Yeager, and...
I'm Ray Goodwin, and we've enjoyed having you folks.
Yes, and so good night for now, and we'll see you next on Wednesday. Those of you who listen live, for those of you who listen otherwise, it doesn't really make any difference when we do it. But anyway, we'll be back on Wednesday, on the 3rd of September, to bring you the next episode. Good night for now.
Good night, folks.